Welcome to Iconic, where we talk about all things 13th Age. I'm your host, JM, and with me as always are Nick, Becca, and Mark.
Hey.
Hello.
Howdy.
Today we have a great episode for you. We are interviewing John Marvin of Dread Unicorn Games about their current books and upcoming projects. John, welcome to the show.
Hey, glad to be back.
Yeah, we've had you on a couple of times. I think our first episode was back in season one when we had you on for The Sun Below, and that kind of started our discussions with you.
All right. Makes me remember that, oh my God, I'm in the middle of a giant edit of the last of the trilogy of The Sun Below.
Well, we'll get to that here in a second. We're excited to hear about everything you've got coming out. Nick and I are both fans of Numenera. Obviously, we're huge fans of 13th Age.
Yeah.
So let's do just a refresher for our fans who may not have encountered Gods and Icons before. Can you give us a little overview of Gods and Icons? And then I know you've added the Tower of Mist and the Upgrade Pack. So if you want to just give high level pitch of all three of those.
Okay. So if you ever go on the internet, and I'm sure nobody listening to a podcast does, but if you ever do, and you're talking to other 13th Age players and game masters, a lot of times what comes up is, hey, I love 13th Age, but I get so confused or it's so slow when I'm doing my icon relationship roles. And so I thought, well, what if I came up with like a whole book that was like half the book was suggestions for what to do with icon relationships. And so that was the whole germ of Gods and Icons. And so that's the icons part. And then I thought, hey, there's no gods for 13th Age. So let's bring in some gods. And I had another writer, Vanessa Rose Finn. She did all the gods, and she's a historian by background, and so she did the gods as waves of invasions. The old gods were worshipped by the original inhabitants, then they were invaded, then the thirsty gods took over. It was and they go, ha ha, we own everything, and then they lose, and the bright gods people come in and say, ha ha, we own everything, and that's where the players come in. And so we did three pantheons like that, and lots, like I said, of icon relationship roles, new magic items tied to the icons, new player races, and it's been a great success. And people are still buying it. It's a product that has legs, which means that it doesn't just sell in the first, you know, two or three months. It just keeps selling. So that's a great thing. Like you said, we have some follow-ons. We have Tower in the Mist, which is kind of a one-shot to advertise or kind of promote some of the ideas you find in Gods and Icons. And it's really good for first-time game masters because it kind of holds your hand and says, hey, when you're passing these standing stones, if anybody has kind of a druidic type of icon, then this kind of thing happens, and it kind of shows you how to weave that into your story. And then I realized I didn't add a lot of monsters, and so that's pretty much what's in the Gods and Icons upgrade pack. A bunch of cool monsters. So it's kind of a mini bestiary. So, you know, just needs more monsters, upgrade pack. And there is your Gods and Icons.
It's a very good product that I would strongly recommend. Do you have any plans on adding any more expansions to it? You know, maybe not just monsters, but maybe exploring some other aspects?
Well, no, not presently, but I'm always open to suggestion. And and presently my to-do list is bigger than my head. So
I feel like that's just, if you're involved in 13th Age, that's kind of your default standard in the gaming industry. You have your creativity quickly outstrips your task list.
Oh, right. Well, I know we're going to get to the Overworld and Beyond. Ash Law did a wonderful job of writing, and boy, was I wrong. I thought, oh, you know, it takes me a long time to write these things. I'll save so much time. I'll get Ash. She'll do a great job. She did do a great job. But if you're still the project manager and the layout person and the art director and the person running the Kickstarter and the person doing all the promos and marketing, it still ate up my life. So, yeah, I did save some time. And what was really cool with Ash is I learned a lot from her by working with a writer of her caliber. It really, I think it helped my writing.
Well, that's awesome. And it sounds like you didn't so much save time as you were able to repurpose time in other directions.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, I always have to do all those other things.
Right.
I mean, I could never afford to hire a layout person that, you know, I'm very picky on my layout. So to do layout the way I want to do it, I have to do it. And InDesign is a wonderfully powerful program, but the learning curve is bigger than the Death Star's learning curve.
Right. And then very little of that actually translates over to any other Adobe product. Each time you step into a new realm, you have to basically relearn.
I know. Yeah. Yes. And I end up needing Photoshop and I need to use Acrobat Pro, but only for really small minor tweaks. I basically spend, you know, 99% of my time in InDesign, but because I need those other things, I have to get the whole suite.
Yep.
Oh, well.
It's called marketing.
That's right. Well,
I know.
So you mentioned Overworld Beyond and working with Ashley, and let's just start talking about that because you actually used the gods from Gods and Icons in Overworld and Beyond.
So many of your listeners probably know if you're a third-party publisher, you cannot use the core Dragon Empire icons. You have to come up with your own. And so in Gods and Icons, I made sure to come up ones with things that were similar enough that you could just kind of like map them in your head. Hey, John's got an undead icon. He's a little sexier than the Lich King, but, you know, but it's easy to figure out which is which. And that's a bit of a no-brainer. Who's the evil dragon icon? Oh, this one. So for the Overworld and Beyond, we use the same icons. Of course, I'm not going to make a new one for every product from Gods and Icons. And I tried to tie that deeply into the product. And so if I mention my, you know, my undead icon, that, you know, is Baron von Vorlach. If you are using your own homebrew or if using the core ones, it's very easy for you as a game master to just go, oh, I know what he's talking about, and use your own. But I try to make sure there's lots of call outs in kind of the outside margins of the pages that'll tell you where to look and more information on you know which icons could be in play and which is not. The working with Ash, I mean, I wanted to do a 13th Age Goes to the Plains, as you all know, because you had us on and we blabbed about it before. But I called up, or I didn't call, I emailed Ash, and she was like so excited. So I thought it would be great, but it's super great.
That's really cool. Can you give us a refresher on what Overworld and Beyond is?
Sure. So Overworld and Beyond is, it started with a one adventure, turned into three adventures and a whole bunch of sandboxy stuff. In fact, enough material that you can run a planar-based campaign from level 1 to level 10. And it starts off in the adventure tier in a place called Caro Hills. And the Caro Hills are where the veil between worlds is very thin. And so you can actually have influences from other planes impacting you as you're like a lowly first or second level character running around. They do things like Ash decided that kobolds and goblins got melded together and became coblins. and there's other kinds of planar wackiness going around in this area. And then when you go to champion tier, there's a big fat adventure where you go to a bunch of planes. And then there's the same thing for epic tier plus. There's a giant transdimensional city that has a huge gazetteer. I think it's my favorite part of the entire product. There's this city that is full of gates to other planes, and we just have this massive, oh, the city at the edge of dawn, and this massive gazetteer with maps and all these weird shops that Ash came up with, and lovely stuff. There's also two classes that are focused on traveling between the planes. There's a Realm Walker class, which is a real teleporter of a lot of fun in combat. And then there's the Void Walker, where it's a pet class turned on its head, where the pet is being impacted by all these mutations from other dimensions. And so as you level, it keeps getting new abilities, and it turns into a giant. It could. You have a huge menu, and you can, in playtest, ours turned into a giant slime monster full of eyes and beaks and crazy stuff, and made people eat weird porridge. that was the playtester in question. Yeah, so there's enough there, a huge bestiary, new magic items, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So there's enough there that if you want to do a giant planar theme campaign, you can. Or if you just want to dive in, you know, have a couple of adventures in the planes, there they are. And either and make your own or pick an pieces of this and put it into your home campaign.
That's awesome.
I just have one question. What does Ashley have with sharks?
Oh yeah.
They're in everything she writes.
Yes. Yes. The Sharkians are kind of these shark orc transplanar freebooters that fly around on giant ships. Yes. Yep. Yep. I've noticed that too. I don't know, but I like it.
Well, I've got the physical copy of Overworld and Beyond in front of me. And I have to say, when it comes to the layout, I love all of the cross-referencing you did in this. It reminds me very much of the Sun Below Numenera adventure, where you were kind of picking up that from the, you know, the Monte Cook Games layout. And I love that you ported it over.
Yeah, I love that layout. I think Monte Cook was brilliant to steal that. He didn't come up with it. He stole it from Dorling Kindersley travel books. Yep. Yep. And so I stole it from him.
All the way back in Tallis, right?
It's a pain in the butt to do, but once you do it, I just can't ship anything without that.
No, I love it. Yeah.
Well, I imagine it takes a lot of work, especially in the PDF, to go through and link everything. But as a consumer of that, it's very appreciated.
Yeah. Now, InDesign does give you some tools to really manage those links. I mean, it's still arduous, but they actually, once you set up a link between A and B, if pages change and whatnot, it tracks those pages. So you can refresh and it'll remember that this section on Sharkians that was on, you know, page 80 is now on page 82. And so it gives you a little bit of a way to kind of conquer all that the complexity that can grow. And it does grow.
Well, and like we've mentioned, the final product is absolutely fantastic. And I remember us having you on in season two talking about when the Kickstarter was going, about some of your ideas of how, you know, what you wanted for it. Now that you've gone all the way from the birth of the idea to the actual final product in people's hands, what changed in that process?
Well, I don't know if you remember, but I was talking about throwing in some cards. And I just thought, oh, that would be crazy. The shipping costs alone would kill me. So I backed away from that in a moment of rare sanity. Like I said, my favorite part really is the gazetteer for the city. And that was a stretch goal. And so that was something. In fact, we were hitting the stretch goal so fast that we were exchanging emails, trying to come up with cool stretch goals, you know, before we met the last one, you know, so we could always have stuff ahead of us. That one's, I just kind of like tossed that out and Ash just jumped all over that. So that was cool.
Awesome.
The classes too were stretch goals. What I didn't understand when you get stuff from Ash is that she doesn't just give you an adventure. She gives you so much more, because there's like all this background information. There's a whole place that you can plug into your campaign, or multiple places. And there's whole sections of like just crazy. It reminds me in Numenera of oddities. Mm-hmm. Just, you know, there's kind of 13th Age style oddities in the back of this. Just crazy things to find in the plains, crazy people to meet. It's not like, oh, here's an adventure. You go here, branches there, and then here's the ending. No, it's way different than that. It's a giant sandbox, really,
right,
with some adventures thrown in the middle of it.
It is. Do you see yourself expanding any of this further down the line?
Well, yes. I'm glad you asked. So I mentioned earlier Ripper of Shriveport. Ripper
yes.
of Shriveport is a... Right now, it's a one-shot that I'm running at conventions to drum up interest in the overworld. And it's a third-level adventure, and it's set in Shriveport, and it's kind of a Jack the Ripper kind of thing, except for the PCs are implicated, and they have 24 hours to solve it, or they get put in the Wicker Man. And it's kind of a race. I think I'm going to expand it a bit so it's not just a one shot. It can be a two shot and maybe have some notes. And it was great because Ash gave me all this information about Shriveport. You know, that's an overworld. And so, which was his kind of H.P. Lovecraft homage. Mm-hmm. And, but it's all mished and mashed up. It's, you know, it's given the Ash treatment. So it's not knowing your Lovecraft monsters makes you enjoy it, but it doesn't give you any advantages because he mixed up who's what and smushed them all together, put them through the blender. I think both of our favorite town in the Carroll Hills, that's where I set this adventure. So that should come out this year sometime, probably just PDF only, unless I go crazy.
Since you've made the transition from player to producer of content, do you still get gaming in at the table?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, good.
I mean, yes, you know, you're really busy as a producer, but I mean, if you listen to interviews, say, with Robin Laws,
mm-hmm.
He is gaming all the time, but his gaming is almost exclusively playtesting.
Mm-hmm.
Mine is kind of half and half.
Well, that's good.
Because I don't have like... you know, Chaosium breathing down my throat for Pavis to come out next week. He has a wonderful group, and so do I. You know, I have a group that will switch gaming systems, that will turn on a dime, and I'll say, hey, I need these new classes playtested, you know, so I, you know, new races or whatever. And so they know how to dig in to new content and really give it a whirl and give me great feedback, really stress it. So I do a lot of my gaming is playtesting, but right now I'm running Numenera, and I just finished a huge playtest and went on for months and months of That's How the Light, the Sun Below, That's How the Light Gets In. And then I thought, before we leave this, all that stuff in Numenera Destiny about building your own city minigame, mm-hmm. let's try that out. And so we're doing that.
Oh, excellent.
Best friends town, and there's too much... drinking involved, but there you go.
Well, I am right there with Chaosium. I really want Robin Law's Pavis to come out. So
yeah, exactly.
Well, talking about new things, this is something I've been very excited about since you mentioned it to me. You said you had something called Camelot coming out, and I'm listening. I'm listening. We're almost done. My son and I, we've got maybe an hour left in La Morte d'Arthur. So this is something that I love. So what is it? When can I give you money for it? And when does it come out?
Well, what it is basically a bunch of mind maps and outlines and just random notes on Post-it right now. So it hasn't gelled into a concrete product. I've got some other things to get out first, but it's going to be big, definitely going to kickstart it. And it will be a big fat book, a source book on how to do Arthurian 13th Age. And of course, you know, the Grail, Arthur, they're all going to be icons. And I'm drawing from a number of different sources, and I'm not going to, I don't know if this will disappoint you. It's not going to be Total Mallory.
I have Pendragon for Total Mallory.
Exactly. That's my point. If you mm-hmm. want to play Pendragon, there's a great Pendragon, and it's called Pendragon.
That's right.
So jump on that. So I'm going to do high fantasy, but with Arthurian high fantasy. So you're going to be able to play all your 13th age characters. And so it's not a new role-playing game. It's a new setting. So you could do, I want enough support that a game master who isn't afraid to like make their own adventures can do a whole campaign, just Arthurian. But I also want a regular campaign that's just knocking around and wants something new to, you know, jump off for a level and go visit King Arthur and get really messed up, all the terrible things that could happen to them there. So that is my goal. I want to really do high fantasy. I want you to be able to play your half orc. Well, how will that work? And I'm still working on that one idea. This is totally just an idea. I don't know if this will work yet. Not play tested at all. But what all the non-humans are actually fey, and they're all under a glamour. So they appear human, but if you have like a magic spell or a magic item, you might actually be able to see their true form. So I want to play around with that. I will set it in 5th century Britain, not real 5th century Britain, the 13th age high fantasy version of 5th century Britain. So it'll be a challenge, but it'll be a lot of fun. And, you know, the research will be so much fun. I'm reading Jean's Markle's The Grail, Celtic Origins of the Sacred Icon right now, and it's given me a lot of inspiration. He was a French author who wrote a lot about Celtic influences. So he posits that a lot of the Grail legends are based on earlier Welsh, more paganish legends, and just, you know, had a veneer put on them so they would be palatable to the 10th century, 11th century readers in France. So, you know, I think I can pull some inspiration out of that for the Druid players, have something to grab onto. I don't want to make anybody feel bad that I was like doing it wrong. Like if you really want a very Christian, the Grail is the cup of Christ, I want you to be able to play it that way. But if that's not your thing, or that would be bad for your table, I want you to be able to not play it that way.
Right. Like was it the Cauldron of Life?
Is yeah.
The legend that you're. Yeah.
It's exactly. Mm-hmm. And yes. And so, and sometimes it's a plate.
Right.
And sometimes it's a cup. And yeah. So yeah, the Cauldron of Life is one of the inspirations, at least according to a lot of people. Mm-hmm. Also, the people that were writing about this, Mallory and many French kind of troubadours running around northern France in the 10th, 11th, 12th century, they were using their worldview. So there were like Muslims who had converted to Christianity as Knights of the Round Table in some of the stories. Mm-hmm. But if it's 5th century, that's before the birth of Islam.
Right.
they weren't very good historians.
No.
No. They were kind of porting their world back. So I want to make it not historical per se, but you know, if it's 5th century, it'll be 5th century. And I'll have maybe the high church take on things, and then, you know, sidebars for other takes on things. So kind of, I always do that in my games, give options to game masters and players. So this isn't just one thing, but it should be. The default will be, you know, a big, fat, fun King Arthur adventure. So, you know, who doesn't love that?
Have you ever thought of the orcs being the Viking raiders types?
Oh, I like that. Or Saxons.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
I trace everything back to the Vikings.
That's right.
You've really laid the framework for an excellent game, another wonderful addition to all of the other 13th Age lineup. And I know you mentioned that it's really currently just kind of existing on post-it notes and in your brain at this point. Do you have any idea, like timeline, maybe 2020, 2021, that you may
but be maybe kickstart at 2020 and ship it 2021? But that's just
sure.
A random right now. I will come out with smaller products, but in between before this is done, because I don't want to like go dry. I want people to remember Dread Unicorn Games exists. So you'll see other things like Ripper of Shriveport. So that way I can keep in people's consciousness so they don't forget poor little John. But this is, I plan on this being a rather big product. It really depends on how well it does on Kickstarter. In fact, if it's popular, I have ideas to do a full Grail Quest role-playing game, but that I probably use Gumshoe for that. I'm focused more on the sacred mysteries. So that's even half a post-it note. And, you know, I'm doing stuff for Numenera and 5th edition as well. And so, yeah, I'll keep busy. The Camelot, I plan on doing dual system. So I'll have a 5th edition version and a 13th age version.
Oh, very cool.
I think the 13th Age version with the icons will be cooler, but don't tell anybody. I noticed you guys recently were reviewing an adventure, that competitive adventure, and they did multi-system. And I'm I'm encouraged to see multi-system people, including 13th Age.
In there,
because I've always seen Pathfinder and 5th Edition. That's very common. But I'm glad to see 13th Age jumping into that, because that's a great way for small publishers. You know, our budgets are really tiny. So if I can reuse the art twice and the flavor text twice, that's really nice.
Well, and converting things to 13th Age doesn't take that much effort. It's really just a matter of relaying everything out and bringing maybe some icon relationships and maybe some different takes on skill usage into it.
Yeah. And then often you actually take out some of the filler combat.
Mm-hmm.
Because 13th Age just kind of, you know, starts with epic combat and ramps up. At least for me, I find when I run 13th Age, you don't have all these stepping stone combats all the time. Usually they're all important to the story for some reason. Whereas when I run 5th Edition, I have to make sure that everybody like gets their experience points to level up and all that stuff. So and also it's 20 levels, right? There may be some of the combat might be tuned to the 13th Age epicness or the 5th edition breadth of the 20 levels. Switching between them, it really isn't that hard. So I'll be doing a bunch of that. I think that this Numenera product will be my last Numenera product for a while. I mean, I love it, but I want to concentrate on heroic fantasy for a bit. Plus, like I said, I can reuse the art better.
So you were mentioning that the Sun Below is a trilogy?
Yes. So there's the Sun Below, City on the Edge. That was the first one.
Okay.
And that's where the players find out that there's actually a world under the surface of the ninth world that Monty Cook gave them. And so I was always hoping Monty never got a shovel. And he never did. He did all these other great things. And I'm so glad. So there's this, you know, kind of a hollow earth type of thing. Instead, I've made it a big tube, but it's the same kind of idea. And there's actually a sun down under the surface, and that's the Sun Below. And so the City on the Edge was a city that was on the edge of falling apart and into civil war. And there's a kidnapping, and the players think that they're, you know, the MacGuffin is they're trying to solve the kidnapping, but they ended up involved in the politics of a giant civil war and helping slave races a revolt if they wanted to. And then I came out with the Sun Below Sleeping Lady, which was kind of a return to going to the Sun Below, but that was very Lovecraftian. And we had, you know, the Numenera version of Azathoth was trying to break through the gates. And the players were supposed to go into a, quote, Numenera mine, unquote. But it was really a giant kind of Death Star-sized spaceship that considered itself a moon. Players were finding all sorts of crazy things and dealing with these, bringing in kind of an Eldritch Horror vibe into Numenera. And then this one is like the overworld. I'm really into interplanar stuff. So this, there's so many planes that you go to. There's even a spaceship with three different planes. And so instead of going to a different deck, you go to a different plane, and one of them is full of horrible, insane monsters. There's a Cthulhu deck or Cthulhu plane. And then there's a city. And I was very inspired by Ash's city. So I did my own city, and it has three different planes that comprise it. One of them has a very toxic atmosphere. So you can walk down the street, end up in the wrong plane, and start gagging. So that's kind of fun. And I wanted to throw the players up against godlike entities, things that you can't directly confront. And then give them options to basically either gear way up so they could confront, or get real sneaky and do Mission Impossible type stuff to get around them, or be really great con artists and talk their way through it. So I actually wrote three different story arcs for the one adventure, and then I mushed them all together. So in playtest, most people jump from one story arc to the other, although my group loves talking.
That's cool.
I use the 7-point story structure, which is something that fiction writers use. Mm-hmm. I use that in a lot of my game design. So for instance, in The Tower in the Mist, I used it there. I used it in a couple other places. The first thing you do is you come up with your ending. And this is great for role-playing game design because, okay, what cool set piece do I want to end on? And then you come up with your beginning. And of course, it's a role-playing game, not fiction. So I always come up with a couple story hooks that people can choose. And then, and the same thing for the middle, but it tells you how to, it gives you a structure. I used to always use the Hero Quest, but that I find ended up, I kept fighting it. It was a little too, it kept wanting to give me railroad plots, and that's not what I like. So most of my adventures, like, it might start and feeling a little railroady, but then it always busts open to some very sandboxy section. And like in this current one, when you jump into this transdimensional city, it's or the transdimensional ship, it both of them are sandboxes. Oh, and I wanted to add Mecca, so I got Mecca. So what I threw so much in there. It's the biggest thing I've ever written, well over 80,000 words.
Well, I had seen on your website that it was going to be available summer of 2019. Are you still on track for that?
No. It's ready for editorial now. And it's been through a lot of playtests. So it's maybe late summer, but maybe fall.
Well, it's one thing that we've seen time and time again is that it's much better to release a well-polished product than to rush it and have it show.
Exactly. I think I got this from Chris Premis from Green Ronin. A game can be late once, but it can be awful forever.
Right.
So you don't want to, to release it before it's polished. And when you're a small company like we are, you try to schedule hiccups, but there's always fun things that come up. Also, I find that my first ideas are often too complex, and so my later ideas get simpler and more fun, because who wants to learn like 16 different ways to do one thing? Let's just do the way, like if I'm doing 13th Age, let's do it the way that Rob or Jonathan would do it, not just come up with something random just because I had an epiphany in the shower one morning.
Well, John, thank you so much for coming on the show and talking about your products. As long as you keep making them, we'll keep buying them and advertising them.
Well,
so
I better get busy.
So where can people find you on the internet?
DreadUnicornGames.com. You can also find our products sold at DriveThruRPG. Those are the two main ways to go. DreadUnicornGames.com is the way I prefer you, because it's mine. Either way works. And I go to conventions, but I kind of don't have a big budget for that, so I go to local conventions.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And I every time you have another podcast, I just can't wait. That's what happens when I'm driving around in my car. You guys are on, through the miracle of Bluetooth, I'm listening to you folks.
Well, we appreciate that. We do.
Looking forward to your Kickstarter on Camelot.
Yeah, I think
we're good.
Awesome. We're ready to check
the song.
Yeah. And if you'd like to support the show, you can do so by becoming a patron at patreon.com/iconicpodcast. Well, you've been listening to the Iconic Podcast.
If you have any questions, comments, or feedback, you can contact us at iconicpodcast@gmail.com or call and leave a voicemail at 720-924-1706.
And be sure to check out iconicpodcast.com for news, updates, and new episodes.
Thanks for listening.